Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. What stealing Roman flags could possibly have in common with encyclicals exclusively Latin? And sharing with you one well-known theologian's comment on Pope Benedict XVI's first encyclical. Is love. That's the title of Pope Benedict XVI's first encyclical, published on the 25th of January 2006, less than a year into his pontificate. In an effort to better understand the message therein, I've asked Sean Patrick Lovett to read some extracts from the English version of this publication and theologian and award-winning author Jesuit Father Gerald O. Collins to take us by the hand, sharing with us some thoughts. Stay tuned.
Many of you will have heard what Benedict XVI said on the 24th of April last year, during the Mass with which he started his ministry as Pope. The punchline in his homily came with the words, "It is love that redeems us. This is God's sign. He himself is love." Pope Benedict then concluded his homily by highlighting what the love of friendship with Christ brings us. If we let Christ into our lives, we lose nothing, absolutely nothing of what makes life free, beautiful, and great. Only in this friendship are the doors of life open wide. Only in this friendship is the great potential of human existence truly revealed. There's a straight line from that homily the Pope preached last April to what we read today in his first encyclical letter, God is Love. In the introduction to the encyclical, Benedict XVI quotes these words from St. John's first letter. He also reminds us at once of what Jesus took from his Jewish faith and put together into a single precept, the command to love God and the command to love our neighbour.
God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. These words from the first letter of John express with remarkable clarity the heart of the Christian faith, the Christian image of God, and the resulting image of mankind and its destiny. In the same verse, St. John also offers a kind of summary of the Christian life. We have come to know and to believe in the love God has for us. In acknowledging the centrality of love, Christian faith has retained the core of Israel's faith, while at the same time giving it new depth and breadth. The pious Jew prayed daily the words of the book of Deuteronomy, which expressed the heart of his existence. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." Jesus united into a single precept this commandment of love for God and the commandment of love for neighbor found in the book of Leviticus. "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Since God has first loved us, love is now no longer a mere command. It is the response to the gift of love with which God draws near to us.
As an expert teacher, Pope Benedict begins his letter by analysing the term love. It's a term used and misused in a wide variety of ways. He wants to highlight the passionate love between man and woman, that ecstatic love often called eros. The Pope defends the true humanity and potential grandeur of such passionate love or eros. But eros needs to be disciplined and purified if it's to become truly dignified and genuinely human.
Let's first of all bring to mind the vast semantic range of the word love. We speak of love of country, love of one's profession, love between friends, love of work, love between parents and children, love between family members, love of neighbour, and love of God. Amid this multiplicity of meanings, however, one in particular stands out. Love between man and woman, where body and soul are inseparably joined, and human beings glimpse an apparently irresistible promise of happiness. This would seem to be the very epitome of love. All other kinds of love immediately seem to fade in comparison. So we need to ask, are all these forms of love basically one, so that love, in its many and varied manifestations, is ultimately a single reality? Or are we merely using the same word to designate totally different realities? That love between man and woman, which is neither planned nor willed, but somehow imposes itself upon human beings, was called eros by the ancient Greeks. Evidently, eros needs to be disciplined and purified if it's to provide not just fleeting pleasure, but a certain foretaste of the pinnacle of our existence, of that beatitude for which our whole being yearns.
Pope Benedict goes on to propose the unity between love as eros or desire and love as agape or self-giving. Eros should grow into a deep concern and care for the other. Then it will no longer be obsessed with seeking itself, but will seek the good of the beloved. It will renounce things and be ready for self-sacrifice. At the end, the Pope proposes a balance between love as receiving and love as giving.
Eros and agape can never be completely separated. The more the two in their different aspects find a proper unity in the one reality of love, the more the true nature of love in general is realized. Even if eros is at first mainly covetous, a fascination for the great promise of happiness in drawing near to the other, it is less and less concerned with itself, increasingly seeks the happiness of the other, is concerned more and more with the beloved, bestows itself, and wants to be there for the other. The element of agape thus enters into this love, for otherwise eros is impoverished and even loses its own nature. On the other hand, man cannot always give. He must also receive. Anyone who wishes to give love must also receive love as a gift.
When we read the Bible, we read a love story, the story of God's passionate love for us, a divine love that is both eros and agape. Our divine lover constantly gives and forgives and wants to receive love from us in turn. This love story, the Pope recalls, reaches its climax with Christ, who is and was the love of God in person. Jesus is the human face of divine love. In his passionate love for us, he gives himself to us in so many ways, above all in the Eucharist. In our Eucharistic communion of love, we are united not only with Christ himself, but also with our brothers and sisters. In that way, the Eucharist unites love of God and love of neighbour. A communion of love with Christ in the Eucharist nourishes and empowers our love for our neighbour.
Union with Christ is also union with all those to whom he gives himself. I cannot possess Christ just for myself. I can belong to him only in union with all those who have become, or who will become, his own. Communion draws me out of myself towards him, and thus also towards unity with all Christians. We become one body, completely joined in a single existence. Love of God and love of neighbor are now truly united. God incarnate draws us all to himself.
In the second half of his encyclical, Pope Benedict moves on to the practice of love, the practice of love by the Church. He understands the Church as a community of love which is energized by the transforming power of the Holy Spirit. The entire Church is summoned to attend lovingly to human needs and to serve human beings who suffer. The Pope recalls the way that the ministry of charity was exercised in an orderly way from the very beginning of Christianity. This ministry became part of the fundamental structure of the Church in her life. The Church has a responsibility not only to proclaim the Word and celebrate the sacraments, but also to exercise the ministry of charity.
As the years went by and the Church spread further afield, the exercise of charity became established as one of her essential activities, along with the administration of the sacraments and the proclamation of the Word. Love for widows and orphans, prisoners and the sick and needy of every kind, is as essential to her as the ministry of the sacraments and preaching of the gospel. The Church cannot neglect the service of charity any more than she can neglect the sacraments and the Word. The Church's deepest nature is expressed in her threefold responsibility of proclaiming the Word of God, celebrating the sacraments, and exercising the ministry of charity. These duties presuppose each other and are inseparable. For the Church, charity is not a kind of welfare activity, which could equally well be left to others, but it's a part of her nature, an indispensable expression of her very being.
In his encyclical, Pope Benedict tackles next the complex relationship between justice and love. On the one hand, the Church is bound to encourage the development of a more just society by the competent political authorities. On the other hand, political initiatives for a more just society can never eliminate the need for the practice of love. In the complex scene of today, the Pope encourages better cooperation between the agencies of the Church and of the state. He welcomes the work of numerous organizations committed to achieving solutions for the social and political problems of our world.
Love, caritas, will always prove necessary, even in the most just society. There is no ordering of the state so just that it can eliminate the need for a service of love. Whoever wants to eliminate love is preparing to eliminate man as such. There will always be suffering which cries out for consolation and help. There will always be loneliness. There will always be situations of material need where help in the form of concrete love of neighbor is indispensable.
Pope Benedict concludes his encyclical by recalling the various male and female religious institutes that existed all through the history of the Church. He recalls two individual men and women like St. Vincent de Paul and Mother Teresa of Calcutta. They are lasting models of social charity towards all people. The Pope ends with a prayer to Mary, the Mother of Jesus, who shows us what love is and from where it draws its power.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, you have given the world its true light, Jesus, your Son, the Son of God. You abandoned yourself completely to God's call and thus became a wellspring of the goodness which flows forth from him. Show us Jesus. Lead us to him. Teach us to know and love him, so that we too can become capable of true love and be fountains of living water in the midst of a thirsting world.
Here in Rome and around the world, Catholics and others have welcomed the encyclical with gratitude and excitement and joy. What remains, however, is to put the encyclical into practice. It has vividly reminded us of the love that God has for us. It's up to us now to respond with love towards God and towards all our brothers and sisters.
Well, I hope you found that enlightening. I certainly did, and that's why I'd like to thank Australian Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins for sharing with us his expertise. Many thanks too to Sean Patrick Lovett for reading some of the extracts from the English version of this publication. Meanwhile, on a lighter note, it's time to join our popular Latin lover as he comes round to speaking of the Latin of the encyclical Rerum Novarum, but not before darting around picking up on my questions regarding St. Bonaventure, the tricks of the German Brennus over a Roman general, and of course, much more. So, Father Foster, last week you were speaking to me about St. Bonaventure. Bonaventure is somebody that I've never really heard of in my life. And last week I was reading Pope Benedict XVI's little biography, and he was speaking about how he wrote that paper about St. Bonaventure and he had trouble with it, etc.
Oh, he's very mystical and very spiritual and very, oh my. He had the famous soliloquies. Mm. Yes, almost like the Confessions of Augustine. He talks to the Lord and the ascent of the soul to God and everything else. Mm. Ooh, that's Bonaventure. It's more spiritual, let's say, than St. Thomas. St. Thomas was a little colder teacher, you know, of theology, but Bonaventure is a mystical.
Can you give me some examples of his Latin?
Well, offhand, I don't know. It's kind of hard, but
you
it
were
just,
saying that he was that
just
was...
it reads right along. Like for example, tria sunt quae in hoc precepto inveniuntur. There are three things which are found in this precept, and he just goes on and just I think a child could understand it. But he's not trying to teach heavy stuff.
So Bonaventure is similar to St. Thomas Aquinas.
Well, yeah, they were friends and everything else. They both died the same year, 1274.
And they both lived in the same place.
Well, they were both going to the Council of Lyons, you know, and they were going to be made cardinals. St. Thomas died down near Monte Cassino.
And Bonaventure,
Fossanova, exactly. And Bonaventure got to Lyons.
What do you mean, Lyons?
Lyon. Lugdunum. Okay, I don't know. I don't know what language we're doing. But anyway, Lugdunum, and he got there, and he died in the midst of the council. Mm. In a massive funeral of the Council of Lyons.
Okay, how'd you say that?
Yeah, ingens concelebratum est eus in cultum et honorem funus. Lugduni in Lyons or Lyon.
Lyon. Lugduni is the Roman word. The Romans had all kinds of fortresses. It was
all the way up to Scotland, of course. They had
It called? Gallia.
The what?
What was France called in those days?
Gallia. Oh, yeah, everyone knows that.
And what was the river that goes through Lyon? Lugdunum? The Rhone, no?
Oh, yeah, Rodanum. R-H-O-D, Rodanum, was the Rhone River. Mm. And the Rhine River was the Rhenum. Mm.
And the Romans had all their boats on these rivers, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, they used that stuff. Of course, they had to be kind of careful because on the other side of the Rhine were the Germans. And the Romans never got into Germany. And every time they got into Germany, they got their, boom, something kicked in. Mm. Wow. They never took over Germany. Never.
Because of Quintilio Varus.
Yeah, that was the worst.
When he had three legions destroyed, no?
Yeah, yeah.
You told me that.
Augustus. And it was bad because the man who did this...
Quintilio Varus?
He was in charge of the Romans. He was very arrogant and stupid, and people didn't like him. Even his soldiers didn't like him. And then we had this German prince who was actually in the Roman army. And then he left and joined his people and started this whole conspiracy against the Romans. And he just took the Romans by surprise, and he massacred them. But it was a trick on his part. Brennus was his name, you'd say, like Breno or Bruno was the German. And he got them, let's make a thing, and let's all march together through the woods. And the Romans...
Black Forest.
Yeah, yeah. And so he said, let's march through the forest, and the Romans followed... This Gaul, who was a Roman soldier once, and they followed him into the forest, but they didn't realize they were going right into a trap.
How'd you say falling right into a trap?
Yeah, in medias insidias, inciderunt. They fell, or incidebant, they were falling. And they were blocked on the both ends, and the Gauls came down from all sides, and that was the end of that.
Mm. There's a statue in the middle of the forest now.
Is that right? I have never seen this. I'd like to see all that stuff. Yeah.
But apparently, I was reading in the newspaper the other day that Hitler wanted all the papers, describing this.
I can imagine. Because when they were able to beat the Romans so savagely...
He wanted to make a huge monument of this.
Exactly. Ooh. And that's why Augustus, they said he was running around the Palatine Hill tearing his hair out and screaming, Vare re de mici aquilas meas, give me back my eagles, my legionary eagles, because the Germans took the flags and everything, which was unheard of in Roman history. You did not steal Roman flags. But there, it was such
How'd you say that in Latin?
A non licebat vexilla Romanorum furari.
Furari are the flags.
Furari is to steal. Vexilla are flags.
Vexilla.
Vexilla. Mm. V-A-V-X-I-L-L-A.
Furare is to steal.
Furari, yes.
Furari.
So it was not allowed to steal Roman flags. Well, he did. Woo! And that's why Augustus was screaming, give me back my eagles. My legionary flags, and he almost went crazy when he heard that. It's almost like Stalingrad for Hitler. I mean, not Salzburgensis. It's a book. I can hear the forest. I know where it is. I know. Anyway.
No, but I was curious to know that, because I knew the story about Quintilio Varus
Well, you have a place, weren't you, out in Tivoli?
Yes.
Well, there you are, Vicovaro. Vicovaro is the town of Varus.
Not only that, but in front of the waterfalls in Tivoli, there was the Villa di Quintilio Varo, his summer residence. You've never been there?
No. By the lake or no?
By there's a Franciscan church, and right next door to that.
No, I don't remember that. But the name of the town of Varus is...
The street there is called Via Quintiliolo.
Oh, Quintilio Varo. Hey, we're living with all that stuff.
That's why I was so curious about Quintilio Varus. That's why I asked you about it.
Interesting stories. And of course, it was his own fault. They say Quintilio Varo was so arrogant and boom, 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 prancing around like a peacock.
How'd you say prancing around like a peacock?
Gloria batur, pavonis instar.
Why do you think Hitler was so interested in this whole story?
Well, I think it was the idea that you had a native, you see, a native in the sense of Gaul or German. Well, Germany was German, really, on that side. That you had this guy and the Germans beat the pants off the Romans bad. which is what Hitler wanted to do with everybody.
So how you say that in Latin?
Well,
you brought it upon yourself.
No, you can't say it. Concedere bracas inimicorum.
Bracas of pants.
Yeah, cut up the pants of your enemies. Oh, you can say everything marvelously. Mm. Except this kind of jargon, this philosophical jargon that's going around. Like how the politicians here in Italy talk. You know, that kind of stuff. Mm. Oh, that's terrible. I mean, realizzazione del programma di questo piano di lavoro mutuo. Ah, shut up. That's how, see, that's what they're doing.
Playing around with language.
Ludere lingua. Yeah, to play with the language. But if it were written in Latin, we always say it, which was the case until Pius XII, or until Paul VI, let's say, or John. Well, John was done. The encyclicals were written originally in Latin. Well, if that were the case, which it isn't, you see, you couldn't do this because Latin doesn't allow you, you know, just to blah, blah, blah. You just can't blah in Latin, which is what they're doing, you see. So they write it in French, Italian, you see. And this just kind of dribbles on and on. And I'm supposed to put this dribble.
How do you say dribble?
Distillationem et fabulationem. Distillatio.
You're referring to the Latin language used.
If it were written in Latin, it would be 10 times shorter. You have to get to the point with a Latin sentence, which they don't want to do, you see. That's why you think of Rerum Novarum, you know? The famous of Leo XIII, huh?
It was a social encyclical.
Yes.
What does it mean, Rerum Novarum?
It means of new things, which means a revolution in Latin. Mm. And the third word is studiosi, and he took those three words from Cicero.
Really?
Certainly, it's a quote from Cicero. Those interested in revolution. Rerum Novarum studiosi. Well, anyway, the fact is he worked about a year and a half. This is the Latinist with Leo XIII. They worked together for about a year and a half and produced 40 pages.
And it was beautiful Latin.
Oh, it'll kill you. Mm. I mean, real solid and no fooling around, you see. Mm. 40 pages in a year and a half, you know. Mm. Now we're supposed to produce 40 pages over the weekend. Well, there's a difference, you see.
How do you say producing 40 pages over the weekend?
Fabricare oportet nos, ad hebdomade finem, quadraginta pagina.
Do you like translating into Latin?
I do. Because it's a challenge, you know. They say this crummy thing in Italian. It's crummy German, too, by the way. And I said, I can say this infinitely better in Latin. And people would agree. Foster, at least your sentences are clear and concise and solid as a rock. Whereas these other people are dribbling around and blah, 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 blah. You don't know what they're talking about.
How'd you say crummy Latin?
Pessima Latinitas. No, deterima. Deterima Latinitas. The worst. The lowest. If they were writing decent Latin, things would be different, but they refuse.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover. As you know, his name is Father Reginald Foster. He's a Carmelite who's currently working as the Pope's own Latinist at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings us up to time. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org/English. Bye for now, and don't forget that we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.